I would like to welcome you all to the William H. Patrick Jr. Memorial Lectureship. The lectureship was established to honor William Patrick, the Boyd Professor Emeritus at Louisiana State University and Division S-10 co-founder. He won international acclaim for innovation and pioneering contributions to the biogeochemical processing and cycling of nutrients, heavy metals, and pesticides in wetlands. The lectureship was created in 2005 by Dr. Ruth M. Patrick and her family and highlights a distinguished scientist who has made significant contributions in some aspect of wetland soils. Our 2010 lecturer is Dr. J. Patrick McGonigal. Dr. McGonigal is a research biochemist and the deputy director of the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. He has expertise in ecosystem ecology, biogeochemical cycling, microbial ecology, soil ecology, and global climate change science. Dr. McGonigal received his bachelor's in biology and a master's in ecosystem ecology from Old Dominion University. And after working for a while as a research associate at the Savannah River Ecology Laboratory, he pursued and completed his PhD in biogeochemistry under Bill Schlesinger at Duke University. He's received several awards, and we know him as the co-curator of the DIGIT exhibit at the Smithsonian. As one of the featured scientists on the Smithsonian Forces website, he displays his love for wetland by siding with Dennis the Menace that dirt is a lot more fun when you add water. So Dr. McGonigal's research interests and expertise in biogeochemical processes in wetlands, and specifically those involving carbon, are background for his presentation today entitled, "Will Wetlands Amplify or Attenuate Climate Change in Response to Elevated Carbon Dioxide?" Dr. McGonigal.
Thanks, Paula. And I want to start by thanking the committee, Paula, Chen Lu Ping, John White, for selecting me as the fifth Patrick Lecturer, I believe, but the first Patrick Lecturer named Patrick. So I feel especially honored by that. I was, you know, like many of the previous Patrick Lecturers, I had the good fortune to meet Bill Patrick at a formative point in my career when I was hired at the Savannah River Ecology Lab in South Carolina as a technician. I think I put research associate in an early version of my resume, try to make that sound fancy, but I was a technician down there. I had my master's degree, and one of the projects I was on was a project that Bill Patrick and Steve Faulkner had funded. Looking at wetland soils. This was in the heyday of wetland delineation and such. And, you know, the first visit that Bill paid to SREL after I'd started was, you know, a very nervous occasion for me because, you know, he was the big boss, the luminary, and, you know, here he comes. But, you know, anybody who knows Bill, he immediately put me at ease and, turned out to be a really generous mentor. Generous with his time, I was always impressed by the amount of time he found to work with me, and he would travel at least a couple times a year to visit. But then also with the data, he turned over the data to me to write, and so first couple of my publications, were with Bill, and he certainly sparked my interest in wetland soils, wetland biogeochemistry, and was a big influence. So this is a special occasion for me. I only wish that I had had a chance to show him through the soil exhibit and show him all the little places I snuck a wetland soil example in with him in mind. But I was able to show Ruth those things. So we're familiar with the idea that elevated CO2 is increasing in the atmosphere, and that's what I'm going to talk about today, its impact on wetlands. The increase in the historical context of the last half a million years is really striking, both for the magnitude of the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the rate at which it has been increasing. And in fact, CO2 in the atmosphere is one of several chemical signals that some use to mark the beginning of the present geologic era, the Anthropocene. As fast as CO2 has been rising in this historical context, in the last decade, it has been rising even more rapidly. This shows CO2 flux to the atmosphere from various sources on the y-axis over since about 1960, and you can see the slope of the increase in about 2000 really changed. And the reason for this, there's a few reasons for this. A big one is just increased global economic activity, and even with the slowdown in economic activity globally, there's still been an overall increase. But also the fact that the energy for this increased economic activity is coming primarily from coal, which is carbon intensive, adds a lot of CO2 to the atmosphere per BTU. But also, and this is a little disturbing, in some ways, more and more of the carbon dioxide emitted to the atmosphere is staying in the atmosphere, which means that as a fraction, as a percentage, oceans and terrestrial systems are becoming weaker sinks for carbon dioxide over time. And so the bottom line of all this is that the effects of rising carbon dioxide are not going away. It looks like the worst-case scenarios of previous IPCC reports in terms of future concentrations of CO2, or at least when we would reach them, underestimated the problem. We know that it's causing climate change, and we know that it's having effects on biological systems. And it's those effects on biological systems that I'll be talking about. And in fact, I'm going to really focus on this one question. The question of whether elevated CO2 in and of itself will alter the balance of carbon dioxide into wetlands sequestration versus methane out. And to the extent that it tips this teeter-totter, it could make wetlands either stronger sinks or stronger sources, either amplify or attenuate radiative forcing of climate. And so I just want to start, you know, with this context so we all on the same page about how, at least I think about ecosystem responses to elevated carbon dioxide. We have, you know, start with the carbon pool, long turnover carbon pool in ecosystems, which is in wood and soil organic matter. Plants add organic carbon to these pools through photosynthesis, productivity, and of course all the plant physiological traits that affect those processes. Microorganisms remove carbon out of these pools through decomposition and respiration. Of course, in wetlands, one product of decomposition is methane emissions, greenhouse gas, but obviously microbial activity is tightly coupled to end cycling in soils, and so nitrous oxide and other forms of N become important. Now, when we are talking about the effects of carbon dioxide in and of itself, we have to remember that it all starts with the plants. If there's no plant response, there's no ecosystem response. We can just quit worrying about it. And so it's kind of unique that way. That is, carbon dioxide is unique in that sense, because several other global change factors that CO2 actually causes and interacts with, like temperature and precipitation, affect both plants and microbes simultaneously, and just sort of fundamentally different feedbacks. The extent to which plants respond to CO2, so if plants respond to CO2, then the plant response can feed back on the microbial response. This is that feedback. So increased energy input to the system through plants will affect microbial metabolism. And then the response of microorganisms through mineralization of nutrients and such feeds back to plants. Another global change factor that will affect both plants and microbes simultaneously is nitrogen deposition, nitrogen availability, and that's one that I'll talk about with in a little bit of detail in terms of the way it interacts with atmospheric CO2, but I won't really be getting into temperature and precipitation in this talk. A few definitions. If I say CO2 effect, I'm really expressing the difference between the ambient elevated CO2 treatments as a ratio of the ambient, so just a percent increase or a fraction increase. But at times, I'll show you data that just shows you the elevated and the ambient side by side, or just this difference, elevated minus ambient, without putting it in a fraction. And there's some slides that have NEE on the y-axis and others that have NEP. I'm more or less considering these to be the same thing. NEE is a specific measure of net ecosystem production that's based on measuring exchange of carbon dioxide. Okay, well, there have been a lot of elevated CO2 experiments in wetlands, and some number of those have actually been in the field, which is the gold standard for doing this kind of work. Not a lot of field experiments in wetlands, but fortunately, the ones that have been done are scattered across a variety of latitudes and ecosystems. There's been several at northern latitudes, one in Tussock Tundra, and a whole series in a climate gradient, latitudinal gradient of ombrotrophic bogs. At more temperate latitudes, we have a brackish marsh example, which is the one I'll really be focusing on because that's where I've done most of my own work. But there's also a variety of field studies that have been done in rice paddies. And then many additional experiments that have been done in greenhouses and mesocosms. So we already know something about wetland plant responses to carbon dioxide, and that's where I'm going to start. I'm going to start with the plant responses because, as I explained, that's where you have to start. And here's a summary of much of the work that's been done. It's not entirely complete, but it gives you a flavor at least for CO2 responses in wetlands in terms of photosynthesis and biomass. And what I've done is organize the studies according to the type of system they were in, with the more northern latitude studies at the top, and then below this line, the temperate and tropical studies. And there's a lot of variability, which I think we all expect, but certainly a trend and some generalizations that could be made, whereby northern latitude wetlands seem to respond weakly to elevated carbon dioxide compared to temperate or tropical systems. So there's clearly something about the plant response at northern latitudes one would think is temperature related, because it doesn't seem to occur at more southerly latitudes. In white here, I've highlighted a couple of experiments that I'm going to use as case studies. I'm going to start off by discussing a little bit of the work that came out of dry Tussock Tundra. Turns out it wasn't so dry. And then this wetland, the salt marsh wetland site, is where I'll spend most of my time. Turns out that the first attempt ever to do a CO2 experiment in the field was in a well. And in fact, it was in a boreal system, Bear, Alaska. I think you got a good idea about the soils in these systems from Chen Liu a little while ago. And on the left is the closed chamber that was used to elevate the carbon dioxide around the tussock tundra. And here is some of the data from that study. So, you know, we have CO2 fertilization here. And this is one of the cases where it's just the absolute difference between elevated and ambient. And what Tissue and O'Shell observed in the study is that initially there was a strong and positive effect of carbon dioxide on photosynthesis, so a big increase in photosynthesis when CO2 was raised. But 2 years later, it had just completely disappeared. And actually, this figure overstates the case because the effect completely disappeared in about 3 or 4 weeks. What happened is that the plants in the ecosystem initially had higher photosynthesis, but then changed their own photosynthetic apparatus to downregulate photosynthesis and bring it back down to what it had been at ambient CO2. It's called photosynthetic acclimation. Now, in a related study, they cross carbon dioxide with a 4 degree C increase in temperature. And in this case, as you can see, there still was some measure of acclimation, but the system certainly did not acclimate down to zero. And so the hypothesis that came out of this was that by warming the system, that the initial photosynthetic acclimation had been due to nutrient limitation. Essentially, there was no available nitrogen to support additional growth. But by warming the soil, they increase nitrogen mineralization in the system, increased nitrogen availability, and that allowed for the CO2 effect to persist. That should be considered a hypothesis. There has been at least one attempt to test this sort of a hypothesis. The Bog Ecosystem Research Initiative in the European Union back early in this decade. And it was a series of five free air carbon exchange rings. And these little rings are face rings. So they're using a different technology than the closed chamber you just saw to elevate the CO2. And these were all in bogs arranged along a latitudinal gradient of sites that differed in mean annual temperature by about 4 or 5 degrees C, mean annual temperature. So the hypothesis was that in places where the mean annual temperature is more cold, there'd be less of a response than in warmer climates. Here's the results of this, and this is one of those cases where instead of showing the CO2 effect, I've just plotted the ambient and elevated treatments next to each other. Green is above ground biomass and brown is below ground biomass for four of the five sites. And asterisks denote significant differences in biomass. If you don't see any asterisks, it's because there were no significant differences in biomass. No responses here. So at least in this particular test, which was not a temperature manipulation exactly, just more a space for time manipulation, no response of these systems to elevated CO2. Now I'm going to contrast this to the site where I've focused a lot of my CO2 research over the years, which is the Smithsonian Global Change Research Wetland. It's located on the Chesapeake Bay near Annapolis. And what takes up most of this picture is the initial study that's still ongoing, started by Bert Drake at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center and run by him up until this January when he retired. He's going to be one of these retired people that, you know, is busier than ever. But it's also the site of several other, at least three other global change experiments that involve elevated carbon dioxide at some level. This initial experiment of BERTS was essentially an elevated CO2 by plant community interaction study, because there were 10 chambers, half elevated, half ambient, deployed into a part of the marsh that's dominated by C4 plants, such as Bartina patens. C4 plants respond very weakly to elevated CO2. Another community dominated by the C3 plant, Chenoplectus americanus, which you know, is typical of all C3 plants, which respond strongly to elevated CO2. So we have a strong responder and a weak responder, and then there was a mixed community. By the way, this study and the companion studies I mentioned were funded by LTREB, and so it's been running a quarter of a century, and we essentially have funding now for 10 more years. So, and it happens to be the second study ever deployed in the field to study elevated CO2. So both the first and the second were deployed into wetlands. Here's some of BERT's long-term data. We have net ecosystem production, or really this is NEE, net ecosystem carbon dioxide exchange, on the y-axis. And the red dots are elevated CO2. The yellow ones are ambient CO2. And you can see a couple of things here. First of all, over this entire record, there's a consistent elevated CO2 effect. Okay, so you know, it was big at the beginning, and way out here it's still big. But there's also a lot of variability. There's some years, in fact, happen to be drought years where the effect disappears altogether. And embedded in this, it turns out that there is a trend, a long-term trend in that variability that BERT was able to pull out recently. This hadn't been published yet, but it does appear that, you know, here's the CO2 effect, that there is a long-term but slow decline in the CO2 effect. And so perhaps in this system, there's also some photosynthetic acclimation going on, which is just happening much more slowly than in Barrow, Alaska, because of the relative difference in nitrogen availability. Now, the idea that there is such an effect is has some explanation for it, and honestly, it's not just observed in this marsh, but it's been widely observed in elevated CO2 studies, particularly field studies. This slow decline in the CO2 response, and it's explained, or a very popular hypothesis to explain it is progressive nitrogen limitation. Progressive nitrogen limitation goes something like this. The system at ambient CO2 has some pool of nitrogen, some, you know, more or less fixed amount of nitrogen it's working with. The nitrogen is distributed between plant and litter biomass, in which it's unavailable to the plant for growth at that point. And, you know, I won't quibble about retranslocation right now, but and the other pool is in the soil, which is more available through microbial mineralization for plant uptake, and there's some equilibrium between the two. In an elevated CO2 environment, especially when you think about how elevated CO2 studies are performed, in which they're at ambient CO2 and suddenly one day they're at elevated CO2 in a square wave type treatment. Initially, there's this big increase in photosynthesis and uptake of nitrogen from the available pool in the soil. This locks more nitrogen away than compared to ambient in biomass and reduces the size of the available N pool. With a smaller available N pool, there's a negative feedback now on further plant response to elevated CO2. And so over time, nitrogen slowly at some rate becomes progressively more and more limiting. That's the idea. Well, we set out to test this out at the Global Change Research Wetland. And we're aware at the time that this idea of progressive nitrogen limitation has some really important global implications. And just to illustrate that, here's a figure out of the 2001 IPCC and then the 2007. In 2001, the models looking at the effects of elevated CO2 on CO2 flux to the atmosphere did not have a nitrogen feedback in them, and they simulated by the end of this century a very strong increasing atmospheric carbon sink because of rising CO2 and increased plant growth and so forth. In 2007, some of the models at least incorporated a nitrogen feedback, and in that case, the response was similar up to about 2050, but then progressive nitrogen limitation kicks in, and by the end of the century, that there isn't a strong sink forced by CO2. So that's the global implication of this kind of this hypothesis. And of course, it's important to keep in mind that nitrogen deposition is one of the global change factors that's certainly more heterogeneous than CO2, but global in nature, that will interact with CO2 responses. And a lot of these red and pink areas you'll notice are right along coasts where there's estuaries and tidal marshes that are becoming eutrophic. So that's the context for this new experiment we started. My colleagues were Don Cahoon at the USGS and Adam Langley, who came on as a postdoc when we first had this funded and really oversaw the design and construction of this new experiment. And it was intended to be a test of N limitation, the interaction between CO2 and N limitation. The design, as always, two levels of CO2 crossed with two levels of nitrogen addition, one ambient, one 25 grams ammonium per meter squared per year in five increments over the course of a growing season, which would be typical of a highly eutrophic estuarine environment. Okay, so here's some data from that. Now, in order to test progressive nitrogen limitation, going back to that conceptual diagram, the first thing that you should observe is that elevated CO2 draws down the soil N pool. That's the first step. And looking at pore water ammonium concentrations here on the y-axis, here's the ambient pore water ammonium pool, and sure enough, elevated CO2 drew that down. Now, the point of our manipulation was to replenish that nitrogen to see if it would then affect the CO2 response, and our added nitrogen brought the available ammonium pool back up very close to ambient. So we were quite happy with the way our test was set up. And then we got some data. And initially, at least, we thought, well, okay, here's 2006, the first year of treatment in this particular study. And what's plotted on the y-axis is the CO2 effect. And so we're back at the absolute effect in grams per meter squared. And then we have two lines, one for with and without nitrogen. And so here's our CO2 effect in the absence of nitrogen in the open circles, about 100 grams per meter squared. And then when we add nitrogen, we get about double the CO2 effect, which would mean that the original CO2 effect was limited by nitrogen availability. So, evidence of nitrogen limitation. But in the next year, the difference between the two declined, and 3 years out, adding the nitrogen actually reversed the CO2 effect. CO2 now was having a negative effect on plant biomass, total above ground biomass. So, apparently the progressive end limitation hypothesis needed some rethinking. And this diagram, although it looks gnarly, Adam calls it a spider diagram. I'll explain it real quick, and I think it does a nice job of showing what was happening, why we got the effects we did. Change in C4 biomass, you can think of this as the CO2 effect on C4 biomass, and just think of it as the change in C4 biomass, sorry. And on the x-axis, change in C3 biomass. And so, here we are the year before the experiment, and then our data in 2006, 2007, and 2008. So these points are all connected in time. And starting with ambient CO2 in red, you can see that over the course of the 3 years, C3 biomass declined and then increased, varied a little bit as it always does, but there was really no change in C4 biomass. I want to make this point that we put this particular experiment in a C3 community, so there initially really wasn't any C4 biomass, or very little of it. Now, by elevating CO2 in these sort of brown or tan points, what we got was a decrease in C4 biomass, and a progressive increase over time in the amount of C3 biomass. And we knew this was going to happen because we'd been doing it for 25 years. Bert Drake, had shown in that graph I showed earlier that there's a CO2 effect on C3 plants. So, that we would have been disturbed if that hadn't happened. Now, when we add nitrogen alone, this is where it got more interesting. We got a little bit of an increase in C3 biomass, but really the strong signal was a dramatic increase in C4 biomass. And when we crossed the two, nitrogen with elevated CO2, we got this intermediate response where both C3 and C4 were responding. And so what we realized that, so what was happening here is that while we had always, Bert had always manipulated elevated CO2 in isolation, when you add another global change variable to that, the picture quickly gets more complicated. And in this case, it turns out that while elevated CO2 favored only the C3 plant and not the C4, nitrogen favored only the C4 plant and not the C3 so much. And so different global change factors, favoring different plants. And the net result was this sort of average that essentially eliminated, for the most part, any strong CO2 effect. And this actually has been observed, looking back at the literature, there's evidence now that with multiple global change factors serve to decrease the positive effects of CO2 in ecosystems generally. And it really highlights the importance of trying to understand sort of species or functional group specific responses to these things. So species are important. I'm sure there's some people here who already knew that. Okay, well, that's enough with the plants. This is a soils meeting, so I'll talk a little bit now about soil carbon sequestration and go back to this data of BERTS, this net ecosystem production data, and define the area between elevated and ambient CO2, which I've filled in now, as new or extra carbon. So this is organic carbon fixed at elevated CO2 that should have gone someplace. And actually, when I first got involved in this work, I was still at George Mason University and wrote a grant to find the missing carbon, we were calling it, new, extra, missing, because we didn't know where it was. Gas exchange measurements showed that it should be someplace, but we couldn't really find out where. We looked at wintertime respiration because they hadn't been making wintertime respiration measurements, and that didn't explain it. We looked at changes in percent soil carbon. I was just telling Marty about all these freeze cores that we did out there, looking for subtle changes in bulk density and percent carbon that would explain it. Nothing or very little. Export of organic and inorganic carbon. I mean, all of these things changed a little, but came nowhere close to adding up to a kilogram of carbon per meter squared per year, which we were looking for. Quite a bit of carbon. But, you know, then I had, you know, become a little more savvy about tidal systems and, you know, begin thinking about the possibility that as, you know, sea level, you know, rises a few millimeters each year, that carbon may be in the soil. It just isn't showing up as a change in percent carbon because it's already a peatland. I mean, the soil in this system is 80% organic matter already. And so a change in the amount of carbon translates into a change in the soil surface. And that's really where we ought to be looking for it. So that was another reason for the new experiment that I just got finished talking about. And it's uniquely designed. It was designed from the beginning to accept one of these surface elevation tables that many of you may be familiar with. They're commonly used in tidal systems. And real quick, this is just a surprisingly accurate and yet simple way of measuring changes in soil elevation. There's a stainless steel, USGS style, benchmark driven just as far as a human can do it. And in the case of Jim Dahl's, out of my lab, that's about, in our system, that's about 7 meters. And so now the top of that rod is your elevation reference. And to extend that elevation reference across the marsh, there's an aluminum arm, a set arm. These are normally, they hold about 9 pins normally. This one was designed for this study. We call it the monster arm, and it has 90 pins in it. it's a transect across the area of the marsh just outside the chamber and then inside the chamber. So we get inside, outside changes in elevation. And then these pipes essentially just allow you to separate changes in elevation to some process that happened within the root zone versus under the root zone. And there's Jim Dahls, who you know, has made all these measurements now over 5 years out there. So yeah, the pins are just used as a way, you lower them to the soil surface and then measure the distance from your elevation reference here to the top of the pin. The marsh is rising, the pins are rising. Okay, and here's some data. And this was our initial hypothesis, but we were just really shocked that it seemed to show up so quickly. So looking at just the kind of orange-brown squares here, that's elevated CO2, and the green dots, that's ambient CO2. And on the y-axis is cumulative change in millimeters. So now this is an environment where apparent sea level is about 3 or 4 millimeters per year. That's how fast the marsh has been rising for, you know, many years now. Compared to the ambient, after 2 years, the elevated CO2 chambers were 8 millimeters higher in elevation. So in 2 years, however much the ambient chambers had risen, or actually they fell a little bit, the elevated chambers essentially doubled the rate at which they were building new soil. A dramatic response, and obviously one that has real implications for the ability of these systems to keep up with sea level rise. If elevated CO2 accelerates sea level rise through increased warming, increased temperatures, why, at least in marshes like this, they may have an increased capacity to build new soil and keep up with that, is one implication. Now, when you cross the CO2 with nitrogen, this effect was cut in about half. And so the implication is that, and the explanation for this, there's a couple of explanations. One of them is the one I just explained, which is the shift in plant species composition. And the other one is explained in this particular graph, where we have fine root production plotted against elevation change with all four treatments, ambience down here, ambient plus nitrogen, and here's elevated CO2. And so what was happening, we think, is that at elevated CO2 without nitrogen, there was a very strong increase in root productivity. The roots were adding mass, but also displacing the soil upward. By adding nitrogen, the plants shifted their allocation from roots to shoots. And so now less of that CO2 response was going below ground, and there was less of a change in elevation as a result. Yeah.
Was there a decomposition component below ground?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't really know, but we have a third experiment that's in its second year now where we're looking at decomposition. And we're looking at it not in terms of leaf litter, which is not the point here. I mean, it's easy to put out leaf litter decomposition experiments, but it's the part that doesn't decompose that becomes soil organic matter you really want to know about. So we have soil organic matter decomposition bags out there that I can tell you about sometime. But I'll know more. Our feeling is that the effects on decomposition are relatively modest. So, in terms of the missing carbon sink that I mentioned, this change in elevation suddenly accounted for about half of what we were looking for. Obviously, it didn't solve the problem, and talking to Bert, the problem gets bigger and smaller depending on how he's analyzing it at any given time. A talk I gave last summer, we had found all the missing carbon, and now I found half the missing carbon. But I know how much I found, I just don't know how much of the missing carbon it was. So, but anyway, clearly this effect of CO2 on soil is significant both for the ability of the marsh to keep up with sea level rise and for the ability of marshes to sequester carbon in the first place, which they do very well. In fact, tidal systems like this have very high carbon sequestration potential per meter square. Per meter square is relevant, particularly if you're buying land and creating a wetland, say, for the express purpose of sequestering carbon. The less land you have to buy, the better. And the reason is that, and the reason this is particularly attractive in a saline system is because not only do tidal saline systems sequester high rates of carbon, but they also emit relatively low amounts of methane, that other greenhouse gas. And in fact, this characteristic of tidal wetlands has found a lot of interest recently in the last couple of years through the idea of blue carbon trading or carbon trading, and there are currently efforts to develop protocols that could be used in official carbon trading markets by which somebody could create a wetland, a small one or one the size of the Mississippi River Delta, and get credit for the amount of carbon that new wetland is sequestering, trade those credits on a market, and make money to help pay for the cost of restoring or creating the wetland. And so this is a very current topic and one that may largely rise or fall on a vote that's going to happen tomorrow in the state. In fact, California is really out ahead, has led this development of a of a carbon protocol for tidal wetlands. And tomorrow, Californians to vote on whether, essentially on whether the state will be allowed to have such a program or not through a referendum. So, you know, there have been people out ahead of this looking at the idea that one would create tidal wetlands to sequester carbon, and Brian Needleman at the University of Maryland, I don't know, maybe Marty, you were involved in this too, have been involved in a created wetland in Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge, paid for through a consortium of energy companies. And again, the idea was to see how much carbon they could sequester in a system like that. But what they hadn't really thought much about, apparently, is that these systems also emit methane. And so here's young Nick Mudd over here. Yes, his name actually is Mudd, which is a great wetland name. And he's measuring methane emissions in this created system. And there's a natural created comparison there, not much difference between the two. But the fact is, it's emitting methane. And it didn't exist until this company paid to create it. And so, yes, they may be sequestering carbon, but they've also created, you know, a new source of methane, at least to some extent. I don't want to be too dogmatic because I really don't understand what the balance is at this point. But methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, 8 to 20 times more potent than CO2. Depending on the time horizon you look at, and it's about a fifth of current radiative forcing, so it has to be taken seriously. Working with Brian Needleman and an undergraduate of his at University of Maryland, Hannah Hoffenbarger, she's just an amazing student at University of Maryland. She's an undergraduate and started this, I think, as a sophomore. Did she start this project? And which was a literature review of anything that had been published on methane emissions from tidal wetlands. And we have this in review now, but it was, you know, ambitious, and she did a great job. And this is what came out of it. You know, clearly there's a relationship between methane emissions and salinity, came out of this review. This is the mean, and this is, I think, the 95% confidence limits of that line. And then plotted on here is data extracted out of Chimura et al., and then plotted according to quartiles. And from this, we conclude that, well, if you're going to create wetland, tidal wetlands for carbon sequestration, you really need to do it on the salty end. Now, the whole Chesapeake Bay is 18 parts per thousand or under. So it's not clear that creating wetlands in the bay the way that company did pays off. But, you know, there's a lot of variability here. That y-axis is a log axis. I really want to point that out. And, you know, a lot to be done before we really understand this. Now, in the context of elevated CO2, the question is, well, whatever the balance is in existing wetland, what would elevated CO2 do to that balance? And I put this up just to say, well, based on a variety of different, you know, published literature, this is some work from Peatlands, and this is Whiting and Chanton's big analysis of wetlands across North America with some measure of plant productivity on the y-axis and methane emissions on the X and methane emissions on the Y. Basically, what comes out of stories like this is that the more carbon you stick into a wetland, the more methane comes out. So, you know, there's really no winning. And in the context of elevated CO2, this seems to be, largely true. So here's a whole variety of studies done in different systems, again, northern latitudes, temperate and tropical latitudes, that have looked at the effects of elevated CO2 on methane emissions, and it almost always increases, except for one study that I think I understand why it didn't. CO2 almost always increases methane emissions, and sometimes very dramatically. Elevated CO2 has more complicated effects on nitrous oxide emissions. This is a study that was done in our tidal marsh, and it actually showed that potential rates of denitrification as a whole declined at elevated CO2, probably because of end competition between plants and microbes. And this is a grassland example, it's not a wetland example, but just to show you, in this study, denitrification actually did increase at elevated CO2. Here's the elevated line with the black squares. But at the same time, the amount of denitrified nitrogen that comes off as N2 versus nitrous oxide goes way up. So overall, it's a more complicated picture, and probably one that's only really relevant to created wetlands or restored wetlands where there is a real large source of anthropogenic N available. Okay, so I'll just wrap this up with some things that I'm certain about, a few things I'm confident about, and then some things that I'm not really too confident about. I'm pretty certain that that elevated CO2 is already enhancing net primary productivity in wetlands at least below 45 degrees north latitude. Above that, it's anybody's guess. But DOE is currently sinking millions into a huge study in a boreal peatland that will be a combination of elevated CO2, warming, and they may have some other treatments that I'm not aware of. I'm also pretty sure that at the same time, elevated CO2 is enhancing methane emissions from these systems. Not real sure about the balance of the two yet. I can say with some confidence that these CO2 effects are going to be strongly mediated by nitrogen availability, and so eutrophication in estuaries and on land. And that this will be due partly just to the availability of N, but partly to the way N affects plant community composition. And so I think projecting CO2 effects is really going to demand that we understand much better how those effects interact with certainly warming, certainly nitrogen availability, probably precipitation. And then, I have a strong feeling that that overall the effects of CO2 on climate will be to decrease forcing in the highly saline wetlands. The increase that we get in CO2 constant methane emissions at CO2 in salty systems tends to be pretty small. But in freshwater systems, probably the effect of CO2 is the other way. It's just going to make them stronger sources of greenhouse gas equivalents. And with that, I really want to acknowledge great colleagues that I've worked with on the data that that I've showed today. Adam, who is still at Smithsonian, but also at Villanova University. Bert continues to be a collaborator. Don Cahoon has been a huge collaborator on this, and Brian Needleman, who I mentioned already. And questions?
Are you seeing any pH effects, soil pH effect with your ammonium treatments?
No. We do measure pH out there regularly, and we've been looking. It's interesting because I wasn't really thinking about ammonium. It's a pretty well-buffered system pH-wise, but I have been looking for pH effects of all this additional respiration that occurs below ground. I thought it might actually make it a little more acidic for that reason, but no. Yeah.
Patrick, so it sounds like that you would expect as the CO2 increases that you're going to get some shift in the plant community.
Right.
So what about these tidal marshes that are sort of monocultures? So is anyone seeing sort of like spatially any differences that are going on that could be related to that? I mean, instead of just looking at production or something like that? Is there someone that's out there doing inventories that are seeing shifts in that would maybe relate to this?
Yeah, good question. Well, one way to answer you is to go back to Burt's original design for the experiment that's been running 25 years now, which had both C3, C4 communities and a mixed community. So the mixed community of C3, C4 was there to test this idea that, you know, elevated CO2 will increase C3 productivity. Perhaps that will then crowd out C4 plants and it'll switch from a mixed community to a pure C3 community. That's one aspect of your question. And that has not happened. It has not happened in all those years. And the reason is that while the C3 does give it, while CO2 does give an energy subsidy to the C3 plant, the C3 plant is more sensitive to salinity than the C4 plants out there. And so every time we have a little bit of a drought year and the salinity goes up in the bay, then, you know, this seems to favor the C4 plants. And so, yes, CO2 is favoring one of the plants, but salinity is favoring the other one. Now, along those lines, we found that nitrogen addition also seemed to favor the C4 plant. So that's, again, an example where these interacting global change factors, nitrogen favors C4, salinity, which is really a climate change-related factor through precipitation, favors C4, CO2 favors C3, and so the net effect, you know, seems to be kind of a wash, at least in this system. Now, there are people who are looking not at CO2, have done some CO2 experiments trying to understand whether it's contributing to the northward migration of mangrove swamps into salt marsh that's occurring. Clearly that's temperature related, but CO2 may be having some influence on that because mangroves are a C3 plant and the systems they're invading are mostly C4. But other than that, I don't think there's a great deal of work trying to understand those community level shifts in real time.
Two questions, actually. Give me a minute. First one is about your nutrient addition experiments. You focused on nitrogen, but there's, you know, some evidence from these kind of slightly saline systems that phosphorus might also be important. And, you know, when you add nitrogen, you shift the balance of the NP ratios and shift things towards a more phosphorus-limited system, maybe below ground as opposed to above ground. So I wondered about that, and if you thought about phosphorus in these systems. And also, you know, it was really interesting to see that the majority of the CO2 experiments have been done on northern peatlands and or temperate stuff, and the only tropical things have been done in rice paddies. So I wonder, you know, there's a lot of wetlands in the tropics, and I wonder if you have thought about how the CO2 changes might, the responses might differ in tropical systems as opposed to the northern ones.
Okay. So you're claiming there's a nutrient called phosphorus?
I'm afraid so.
Okay. Well, that was last year's Patrick lecture, so I'm sorry. Admittedly, phosphorus gets, you know, short shrift when it comes to these kind of experiments. And I think there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One is that the link with nitrogen has a very, not that phosphorus does it, but nitrogen has a very strong link to the Rubisco enzyme. And so this downregulation, photosynthetic acclimation I was talking about is all known to be mediated through nitrogen availability. And, you know, that's where that explains a lot of the early work on that connection. Plus, terrestrial systems are strongly N-limited. And so, you know, that was a reinforcing factor. Now, particularly in greenhouse experiments, people have manipulated phosphorus. They have found out that phosphorus availability can limit CO2 responses by plants. And so I think there's, you know, certainly systems where you would rather be fertilizing with both N, NP, or with P. Certainly in, you know, tropical soils, highly P-limited soils in the tropics, you would want to be thinking about P. And maybe in a marsh system like this, I mean, it's an organic soil, and all of the phosphorus is tied up in organic compounds. And but, you know, quite honestly, we haven't tried that. Your point about the lack of CO2 experiments and just kind of natural tropical systems is a great one. And yeah, my hypothesis has always been that is where you'll get the really big effects of elevated CO2 on methane emissions. And when you look at the size of some of those numbers I put up, an increase of 100% or more, you know, there's a lot of interest in methane emissions from the tropics anyway. There was all that work published in, you know, Science of methane being emitted from tree leaves, explaining why methane pools above tropical forests more than you would expect. Well, you know, the ongoing effects of CO2, you know, could easily overwhelm that kind of a signal. And so I think it's really important to look at. It just hasn't been funded yet. Maybe you're the guy to make that happen.
Have you seen any shifts in the microbial communities or anything with the treatment then?
You know, we have a colleague who's working on that now, and people have worked on this question quite a bit. We'll probably know a lot more in a couple of years, because there's a huge DOE-funded cross-site comparison going on now. But just based on some work out of my lab, you know, there certainly are changes in microbial communities. Trying to say anything useful about what that means is really difficult. Okay, things have changed. There is one example I have where it's an upland example. We had an elevated CO2, Bert Drake again had an elevated CO2 experiment in a scrub oak forest in Florida. And it was interesting because there, over time, the soil was losing carbon. I mean, the trees in the forest increased productivity by like 60%. That's a lot of additional carbon. But that carbon, the soil itself, lost carbon over a decade. And we were able to figure out that the reason for that was microbial priming, that with increased carbon inputs to the soil from increased plant growth, there was now a nitrogen demand. And that nitrogen demand was met by a shift in the microbial community that favored increased production of extracellular enzymes capable of mineralizing even recalcitrant carbon compounds, which are rich in nitrogen. And so the ecosystem level response was essentially to mine nitrogen out of soil organic matter to support ongoing plant growth. And so this priming effect is one very clear place where a shift in microbial communities, in this case, but in some cases it may just be microbial activity, started with the elevated CO2 response of plants.
I like your accretion study. That was pretty high rate of accretion, 8 millimeters or whatever. But still, sea level rise, predicted sea level rise is going to swamp that, isn't it? By a long shot or what?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And the subject of a study that we are in the second year of right now, where we cross CO2 and nitrogen with water level. And the thing to keep in mind is that in our manipulation, sea level was fairly static, you know, varying however much it varies per year. And keeping in mind that carbon sequestration in these systems is really driven by burial. The deeper the water over the soil, the more burial there'll be and the more preservation there'll be. And so So in a future scenario where the rate of sea level starts to pick up, becomes faster and faster, the rate of burial will become faster and faster. And I think as long as the plants can avoid being drowned, that 4 millimeters a year could be much more, because more of the plant productivity ends up buried. Now that's up to some limit. We know there's a critical limit where that just all falls apart. And we think that, and this is actually in that paper, the same paper that elevation changes, we actually do some projections there showing where the CO2 effect is liable to stop being useful. We essentially think that the CO2 effect on C3 marshes will help systems like that keep pace with sea level rise for the next century and then start to fall apart for reasons like the ones you suggested and others. But and so we think what it means is we have a window of opportunity to deal with, you know, climate change, at least in the context of marshes. Dan. Well, it's because methanogens are at the very bottom of a microbial pecking order, in which any other organism that uses organic carbon as an electron donor and would compete with methanogens for organic carbon tend to outcompete the methanogens. So in a saline system, it's really not the salt, it's the sulfate. And so if you have a salty system without sulfate, it works a little differently. But if there's sulfate around, sulfate-reducing bacteria outcompete methanogens as a general rule. You know.
Well, Patrick, I'd like to thank you again for your presentation.